Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, librarian for religious studies and theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with James Crenshaw about his recent two-volume work, Sipping from the Cup of Wisdom. Dr. Crenshaw received his PhD at Vanderbilt and taught here for 18 years before going on to Duke University, from which he retired in 2008. Jim, thanks for being willing to do this interview.
Thank you for having me.
This two-volume set is, as the title suggests, about the wisdom literature of the Bible. Yet your early works were on the Hebrew prophets. Your dissertation, which was later published as a book, was on Amos, and your first published book was on prophetic conflict. So I'm wondering, how did you move from a focus on the prophets to what you are arguably more identified with, wisdom literature? And what continuities, if any, do you see between your work on the prophets and your work on the wisdom literature?
Mm-hmm. Well, I really never gave up my study of prophecy.
Okay.
As late as 1993, I published a book on Joel in the Anchor Bible Commentary. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a couple of articles on theodicy in the prophetic literature and theodicy in the minor prophets. Mm. They were published in German volumes. And the when I was studying the prophetic conflict, I was not interested in the oracles. And thus says the Lord, or whisper of the Lord, the content of the oracles. I was really interested in the voice of the people, their response to the oracles. And also much of the study, the dissertation and prophetic conflict was concerned with theodicy, with the question of divine justice. And wisdom literature covered the same areas. But I moved into the study of wisdom because in about 1965 or 6, just after I'd begun teaching, Hans Walther Wolff, who was at Mainz at the time and later at Heidelberg, wrote a little book called Amos Geistige Heimat, the intellectual climate of the prophet Amos. And he argued that Amos was trained by clan wisdom scholars in the little village of Tekoa. And he said that his commentary, which was forthcoming, the Biblischer Kommentar series, would interpret Amos from that perspective. A wisdom scholar. So I thought he was totally wrong. And I noticed that so many recent scholars like Talmon had written claiming that Esther was a wisdom book. And Norman Wybrey wrote on the succession document in 2 Samuel through Kings, saying that that's really a proverbial text. And Gerhard von Rad had argued that the Joseph story was wisdom. And then Weinfeld claimed that the whole book of Deuteronomy was wisdom. So I wrote an article called Method in Determining Wisdom Influence on Wisdom on Historical Literature. And it was published in Journal of Biblical Literature. And as a consequence of that article, Harry Orlinsky, the editor of the Library of Biblical Studies, the Jewish library, asked me to edit a volume, Studies in Ancient Israelite Wisdom, which I did. And as a consequence of that publication, I was asked to write a commentary on Koheleth, Ecclesiastes, and then a lot of articles for Anchor Bible Dictionary or for Oxford University Press on Job and Koheleth. So obviously I was really interested in wisdom by that time. So that's how I shifted from the study of prophecy to wisdom texts.
So this question, the answer to this question could probably occupy the rest of our conversation, but I hope it doesn't. And that question is, what is wisdom?
It could. It depends on how the scholars interpret it. Each scholar has a different definition. And I notice I have three. My introduction to wisdom is now in its third edition. And each time I give a slightly different interpretation. My final interpretation or definition is that wisdom is the reasoned search for specific ways in which I can ensure well-being in daily life. Now, that's wisdom in Proverbs. Wisdom in Job is the attempt to make sense of extreme adversity through theological debate. And for Koheleth, it's really the attempt to understand the vexing anomalies of existence. Why is life so contradictory? And for Ben Sira, who is much like Proverbs, wisdom is the attempt to transmit the insights that one has gained to successive generations and to enable them to embody those insights. Now, I think that's wisdom. And along with it, you would have to say that the wisdom texts use certain language, and particularly terms like bina, understanding, or da'at, knowledge, the attempt to say that there is a specific vocabulary. But the problem with defining wisdom that way has been that everybody uses language like intelligence. We can say he's smart, she is smart. There's been a lot of attempts to say that there were the wise woman of Tekoa, for example, is a sage. She's a scholar. When all she does is she's a good actress. And Joab puts all the words in her mouth. So how could she be a sage, a scholar? So it's my attempt has been to say that we have certain vocabulary, but it has to be technical. And the word hakam, hakamim in Koheleth, is certainly a technical use. When in the epilogue, it says that Koheleth was he was a hakam, and it's using it in a technical sense, and it says that he taught the people. And there it uses the technical term ha'am, and which is really strange. Why does it say he taught ordinary people rather than saying he taught limudin, the students, or banim, the sons, as it is in Proverbs? In Proverbs, it's always bani, listen, my son. It uses that vocabulary. So you can interpret wisdom in terms of its vocabulary. You can also use central focus. And there you would have chokmah, that is wisdom itself. And Proverbs just constantly uses the word chokmah. It personifies chokmah, which we'll talk about. And it also... you have chokmah in the book of Job as a main theme. Koheleth also, and Ben Sirah, and even Wisdom of Solomon, which goes, it uses it as the equivalent of logos, the rational, universal thought of God. So you can use that, or as the leading German scholar Walter Zimmerli had said, wisdom is really creation theology. The structure of wisdom is always, it has to do with either creation or order. So there are many ways of going about defining wisdom.
But you've said, it sounds like you've settled in a way where you actually need to look at individual, I mean, you have this vocabulary, but you also have individual emphases and individual wisdom texts.
That's right, and I think that wisdom differs according to each of these books. So wisdom is historical. It's funny because we've always said wisdom is not historical. The big difference, but back when I was in graduate school, most of the emphasis was on what is called Heilsgeschichte, saving history. And wisdom literature was completely eliminated. They didn't even take it up. And the reason was, and they made a distinction between God acting in history and God acting in nature. And the scholars claimed that God acting in nature was cyclical, and it was pagan, Canaanite. The opposition to that, they said, is the biblical text, which has God acting through history. And so wisdom wasn't historical. But the truth is, wisdom changes with history. And we see it clearly with Ben Sirah, who introduces the historical narrative from the Bible, as it even has the whole history of divine dealings with God from Abraham, Moses, right on down to the very end.
Now you just mentioned five books. And the five books of the Bible that are identified as wisdom literature. And in fact, the first volume of Sipping from the Cup of Wisdom, which is entitled Exploring Diverse Paths of Research, organizes and comments on scholarly work that's been done on these five texts, Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, or Kohelet, Ben Sirah or Sirach, and the Wisdom of Solomon. And you've indicated what makes these individual texts wisdom literature. Why aren't other texts wisdom literature? You've talked about several short texts throughout the Bible. The succession narrative, the Joseph story. Some people say the Song of Songs is is a wisdom text. So are they? They're just missing the vocabulary. They don't have the orientations that you mention about that each of these wisdom texts have. Is that what leaves them outside of the wisdom fold? Yeah.
Well, let's take Song of Songs.
Okay.
Song of Songs is clearly erotic poetry. It's comparable to the texts in ancient Egypt. There are 43 of these so-called erotic songs that Michael Fox has discussed so beautifully. The Song of Songs nowhere emphasizes chokmah, wisdom. As do all these five texts that I've mentioned. It mentions ahava, is love. That's the one thing, or lust, whichever you choose to say. So it is not interested in teaching children as Proverbs or Ben Sirah, or teaching more mature scholars as Job Wisdom of Solomon, and Koheleth. Mm. So it's a completely different content and function. And so that's why I would say Song of Songs is not wisdom, mm-hmm. in spite of the claim by Roland Murphy, my predecessor at Duke. So, no. And for example, Deuteronomy is legal text. And clearly there's pedagogy and there's homiletics. But it's so different from anything I find in these other five books. But wisdom, even in the ancient Near East, you have the parallels to Koheleth in Mesopotamian texts. The Gilgamesh epic, Koheleth quotes a text, or at least he has a text that sounds just like the advice that the alewife gives to Gilgamesh, enjoy life. So you have parallels like that, and you have the parallel, a threefold chord, that you have that in Koheleth and Gilgamesh. But wisdom literature, you have Sumerian proverbs that are very similar to the biblical proverbs. But wisdom, as Mesopotamian scholars recognize, wisdom in the ancient Near East is pure magic. It's priestly, and that's quite different from what we have in the Hebrew Bible. Mm-hmm. So they're defining wisdom, even if one uses ancient Near Eastern texts, becomes a problem. Mm. With Mesopotamia, you have two kinds. And in Egypt, you have the proverbial, and all the proverbs from Amen Imhotep, which are found, you have 13 of them found in the book of Proverbs. So there are similarities in the Egyptian text. So at least it is, I think it is possible to use the function and the vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And the vocabulary has been studied very extensively by Neely Shupack to show that much of the vocabulary in the Hebrew Bible is similar to the vocabulary in ancient Egypt instructions. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex issue, and we haven't solved it yet, right. And I doubt if we ever will.
Right. But you're very fairly clear about what the lines are in terms of in defining the wisdom literature.
I am. Yeah. I think so.
So in the first volume, you discuss a number of issues that have come to the fore in recent scholarship, and I'm going to ask you about some of them, but listeners are going to have to read the volume to get the full story. One of the issues is the social setting of wisdom. Various scholars have argued that wisdom literature had its origins in one or another social context, for example, the home, schools of one kind or another, the court. What evidence do we have for these options? And maybe more importantly, certainly additionally, how does knowing the social setting of a particular text affect how we read it?
Okay, once again, you have to look at each book. And there's been a lot of discussion of schools in ancient Israel. André Lemaire, the epigrapher from France, claimed that there was a whole system of instituted schools throughout Israel. The book of Proverbs clearly shows that the background is the home. The parents, the mother and father, are instructing the child. Now, where it becomes complicated is that in Egypt, the same word, Bani, my son, the Egyptian equivalent refers to a student. Mm-hmm. So is the question arises, is Proverbs using Bani in that sense? Mm. So there are some who still claim, yes, it is. The problem with claiming that there are schools everywhere is there is absolutely no evidence in the ancient Near East for it. Mm. We have, as late as Bensira, we do have the invitation, come to my school, Beit Midrashi, House of Learning. And but Michael Fox has claimed that even that is a symbol for my book. Come to my book and learn from it. The whole question of whether the epigraphic evidence will support the existence of a school has been discussed rather extensively. There are certainly some drawings. There are some sort of etchings and a few letters of the alphabet are found in two places, in two caves. And the question arises, would students have been able to make their way into those caves to study? And why would they study there? So Stuart Weeks at Oxford has argued that these do not support a claim that there are schools. And if you go to the book of Job, most scholars recognize that these debates, they're theological debates, and they're for scholars. They wouldn't be for little children. So maybe we did have advanced learning. And that's so how did we get to that? With Bensira, we discover, yes, we have someone who is an actual teacher inviting people to come either to his book or to his house of study. And but the strange thing is, nowhere in Proverbs does it mention a school. If you had a school, surely they would mention it somewhere. They do talk about spending money for wisdom, to acquire wisdom. And it is certainly clear that they valued learning. But there was no incentive to have a school. If you think about it, they were agricultural. These were villages, small villages. They needed the children to work. I doubt that there was were schools. I think the learning was a result of a few scribes who usually taught their own children and a few others, and that was sufficient. But now the question arises, what about Proverbs 25 through 29? There's an inscription that says, these also are the Proverbs from which the men of Hezekiah collected. Now, the men of Hezekiah suggests that these are scribes who are employed by King Hezekiah. If that's the case, we would have a court, and we have courtly scholars. So, and Proverbs 25 through 29 do refer to kings and to behavior in front of kings. Koheleth does the same thing. So it is possible that we had, first of all, parental education on a lower level, and subsequently we had courtly scribes trained at the court of Hezekiah, and then by the time of Ben-Sirah, which is 2nd century, very late, about 180 to 185, Ben-Sirah was a priestly scribe and fairly significant. He quotes, or he at least has a whole section of his writing that sounds just exactly like the instructions in Egypt about the vocations. So he's aware of it. I think he's aware of it, of Egyptian texts. Mm-hmm. So these are scholars. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, different settings, mm-hmm. and I think we have to interpret each of these texts on the basis of those different settings. Mm-hmm. And the difference is, you know, Proverbs, if it is parental instruction, it is not just the inside of one father. It's a path. They use the language of path, pathway. And it's a path that has been trodden by many feet. And it's the insights of numerous scholars. Mm-hmm. And so we interpret it on the basis of almost village concepts. And for Ben-Sirah, who has become a scholar who's interested in primarily the insights of that can be brought together into law, he claims that all of these insights that he has found are equivalent of Torah, so the Mosaic Torah. So what he wants to do is bring together the narrative tradition and the wisdom tradition. Mm-hmm. And he does that fairly well, I think. Mm-hmm. With the Wisdom of Solomon, the difference it makes is that here we have a totally different culture. This is in Alexandria. And so the presuppositions are different from the ones you'd find in the other three books, or four books. And so what he has to do is make sense of Greek concepts of, for example, immortality of the soul. So he uses that notion defend the justice of God. And then one of the major problems he faces is the conflict between Egyptians and Jews. And the Jewish tradition in the Bible about Pharaoh and about the treatment of the, you know, the Pharaoh's children. Right. I mean, killing all of them. So Wisdom of Solomon has to justify God's killing of firstborn. And he goes about it by saying that God was concerned about the possibilities of idolatry and so forth. So the whole issue of idolatry comes to the fore. All these are new problems, or at least problems that have become so acute that they must be addressed in wisdom. Mm-hmm. And apocalyptic is the same way, because now we have apocalypse against empire. We have the empire has begun to afflict the people and to limit their religious freedom. And so Wisdom of Solomon has to to try to respond to that issue. And we aren't sure whether those three chapters in Wisdom of Solomon have been added to the text or not. Many scholars think they are additions, but at least it shows that the issue has become paramount to them.
So, as you said, the wisdom is historical. I mean,
it is.
In terms of content, and you were just talking about some aspects of the content of wisdom literature. Wisdom literature shows some internal thematic similarities in some areas and internal thematic differences in other areas. And the differences, which we'll discuss in a few minutes, are often explained through a socio-historical narrative on which the various wisdom books are mapped, or at least that's my kind of way of articulating what I'm seeing in the scholarship that you're looking at in these two volumes. But first, an example of the internal thematic similarity is the general wisdom emphasis on God as creator, which you mentioned earlier in our conversation. And that's set against this strong emphasis in the rest of Scripture on God as the Redeemer. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the nature and significance of the wisdom emphasis on God as creator, and then how that varies in the various books over time.
Yes. I mentioned earlier that Simmerle thinks that creation is the central focus of wisdom. And my former student, Leo Perdue, he emphasized creation in a number of works. Creation, for example, in the book of Proverbs, basically, until Proverbs 8, you have and in the other Proverbs, besides Proverbs 8, the emphasis is on God as the one who created both rich and poor, servant and master. In other words, God created everybody, and we therefore are responsible toward God for how we treat the other people. Proverbs 8, however, is very different because, and here we're beginning to look at the personification of wisdom. There, God is basically, its cosmogony is emphasized. That is, the creation of the universe and the ordering of the universe so that we can have stability. And the personified wisdom is described as being in the very presence of God at the beginning. In other words, when creation took place, when he established the firmament and the hills and said to the sea, you can come this far and no further, when all of that, the cosmogony, was being formed, wisdom was there. And wisdom was dancing in God's presence and delighting God. And we don't know how wisdom seems to be patterned after the goddess Ma'at in ancient Egypt. And Ma'at is the god of justice and order. And she holds truth in one hand and life in the other, or truth and justice. And we have those same claims about wisdom in Proverbs. So Proverbs 8 then has this peculiar word, amon, or amun, depending on which vowel we attribute to it, which seems to imply that wisdom is either the architect or craftsperson, or she is the little darling, which would be almost erotic. And that theme is developed in very late texts, in Qumran. So creation then has these major emphases of cosmogony, but we have the personified wisdom. When you go to Job, cosmogony is the major emphasis, and there are several hymnic texts where it describes the way people respond to the creation event. But when the Yahweh speeches take place, God describes the formation of the mountains and the hills and the celestial beings, stars and planets and everything else. All of this is described. But then the creative event moves to talk about the wild animals. God created all of those animals, and Job wasn't around when any of that took place. Human beings just play no role in the divine speeches. The only place they're mentioned is a kind of ridicule. Can you control the two monsters, Bahamut and Leviathan? Can you look upon the proud and make them humble? If you can do that, then you can accuse me of wrongdoing as your creator. So creation in Job is cosmogony. When you turn to Koheleth, creation, there's really, as it has been said, a single consonant between creation, creator, and the grave. That word, bareoke. Is it creator? Remember your creator? Or is it remember your grave? Or is it remember your wife? Your that's cistern. So, and the later rabbis saw all three of them in that, and I suspect that's right. That there is a pun, if creator is at all implied, it would be either creator and cistern and death. Those three things to keep in mind while you're young. I sort of doubt that the creator is implied, but it may be. If so, it has to be a plural of majesty. But it's a rare word. Elsewhere, creation is implied by Koheleth when he says that God has created everything beautiful. And he uses the word tov, and it is yafe. But it qualifies it by saying ba'ito, in its time. So everything is beautiful in its time. And temporality is the crucial term in Koheleth. I think it's also true in Proverbs, to a sense, you're to know when to speak. And once you know when to speak, you have to be eloquent, know how to speak. And then beyond that, you have to speak the truth. So integrity is involved. And then a fourth quality is restraint. You have to be able to keep your passions in check. So now creation in Koheleth then is God has created everything beautiful. But then it goes on to say that he has placed something, and the word is either olam or elim, and it means eternity or mystery, hiddenness. You've placed both of those. You've placed them in the human heart, and yet you've made it so that they can't benefit from any of those. So it's a strange concept of creation. Mm-hmm. Now that's creation in Koheleth. When you turn to Ben Sira, where it's very similar to the hymns in Job, and which one of my students called dubious praise. But for Ben Sira, the chapters 38 and 39 especially, they go on to describe the marvels of the universe, the beauty of the sun. Everything is splendid, wonder, awe, majesty. And that's the response to the Creator. But here, creation has taken on Stoic implications. In Stoicism, Stoic philosophy, you have the ordering principle of the universe is a balancing of good and evil. And Ben Sira takes that up and says that God has balanced everything out. But in a way, God uses nature to punish wickedness. So Ben Sira adds a psychological element to the punitive in the wisdom text. And Wisdom of Solomon adds that and expands on it. It becomes very impressive how all the people, the Egyptians, are frightened to death of specters and all of this. So he combines the Stoic universalistic concept and the psychological angst, which is, I just wrote an article on psychological angst in Koheleth.
Oh.
And so, yeah. So that's also of the way wisdom has developed in the concept of creation.
Mm-hmm. So to say that it's, that they hold creation similar doesn't really say much of anything.
not really.
Without the explicating.
Now you actually have Redeemer too. In Wisdom of Solomon, it comes in the back door because wisdom, it is spirit, the divine spirit, who has led the Israelites from the very beginning, from the time of Moses right on to the present. So now we have the Redeemer. God is Redeemer as well as
Creator, yeah, coming creator. Together. At yeah. In this late book.
Mm-hmm.
As you make clear in your survey, and actually as we're hearing, even with these themes that are similar or held by all of the wisdom books in one form or another, some of the wisdom books differ from the others quite substantially. And I think, as we've been talking about wisdom literature differing over time, I think you can kind of map, or they these differences that you see have been mapped in sort of a socio-historical way. And I'm thinking in particular of some of the descriptions of how wisdom has developed, the crisis of wisdom is one example, or the whole issue of Hellenization, how Hellenization has affected, or how wisdom can be mapped on this process of Hellenization, increasing persecution and injustice, chaos, enemy, and then all of these socio-historical understandings. They're not mutually exclusive. They can all be going on at the same time. You've talked a little bit about apocalyptic, and you've talked about the personification of wisdom. So how do these ideas, apocalyptic? How do the personification of wisdom, how do you see them mapping onto these socio-historical changes? You've kind of hinted a little bit, I think, with your discussion of apocalyptic, but if you could talk a little bit more about how apocalyptic developed, I mean, why it developed at the time that it did, you know, why we don't necessarily see it earlier. Mm-hmm. Is there a way of understanding this personification of wisdom as a historical sort of, the way it's developed as a historical sort of development? I mean, I think that's what you talk about in the book.
The apocalyptic,
yeah,
it's very difficult to decide how it arose.
Hmm.
Gerhard von Rad, in his marvelous book, Wisdom in Israel, argues that apocalyptic is a child of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a long critique of that. And I don't think it really is. I think apocalyptic is the product of prophecy.
Hmm.
And the reason I say that, von Rad claimed that it's the notion of the divine control of the times.
Mm-hmm.
That is what is found in Kohelet, for example,
mm-hmm.
and in Ben Sira, and that makes the wisdom and apocalyptic similar.
Mm.
My argument is that even in Koheleth, where there are two recent articles about apocalyptic in chapter 12,
mm.
And I can't see it at all. What they claim is that this dark, dismal depiction of old age because the sun and the moon and so forth are darkened, that's apocalyptic, but it goes on then to say that the people go around, they have the funeral procession, life goes on as usual, and that's certainly not the case in apocalyptic, So I don't think it's apocalyptic at all. I think what we have here is simply a description of a failing plantation or a failing house being destroyed, and then the symbolic description of old age, what happens to us when we get quite old. So I don't see that as apocalyptic at all. Apocalyptic is primarily the use of symbolic figures, as in Ezekiel, late Ezekiel, and in Daniel, and in the book of Revelation. The assumption is that there's persecution, extreme persecution. That is not the case in wisdom literature. And we don't have persecution at all in Proverbs, in Job. And apocalyptic is primarily interested in the larger entity, not just the individual. Wisdom is always concerned with the single individual. And so apocalyptic is different in that sense as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I guess I don't see it as wisdom and apocalyptic as in any way co-equal.
Mm-hmm.
There, David Winston has noted that in the Wisdom of Solomon, the intense animosity in those three chapters that are apocalyptic, that they must come from the time of in of Roman persecution of Jews. And so that's a different historical context from what we have in Wisdom. Wisdom is conservative. It is primarily interested in conserving the values, traditional values. Apocalyptic arises in a time of persecution, and its main emphasis is on consoling the community so that they can survive. So those, that's at least the way I would approach the problem. But it's extremely complex.
So I wanted to move to the second volume, Sipping from the Cup of Wisdom, which is entitled Faith Lingering on the Edges. And it collects pieces that you've written for a variety of publications, though one of the essays is new to the volume. And again, we won't be able to discuss every piece in the book, but I did want to provide listeners with some sense of your concerns. And the first question has to do with Qohelet, which I think it's fair to say dominates dominates this volume. I mean, that makes sense. You've written a lot on Qohelet. So what drew you to Qohelet in the first place? And in what ways have you seen your understanding of the book change over time?
Yeah, I guess when I was a graduate student, I read a lot of existential philosophy. And so the novels, Camus and Kafka, and writings of Sartre, and I could not find anything in the Bible in the way it was being interpreted that satisfied me. I was trying to find something that really appealed to my thoughts at the time, and Qohelet was one who seemed to meet my needs. So it was really a personal quest, I guess, more than anything else. My denomination had failed me. Basically, I had gone to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, which was a good seminary at the time, and they fired 13 of my professors.
Wow.
And I had planned to stay on there to get my doctorate, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I came to Vanderbilt to get my degree. But there was this struggle. Authority was the big issue. Southern Baptists were fighting over the inerrancy of the Bible. And none of that made any sense to me. And Qohelet spoke to me because the issue of take life as it comes to you. Life is meaningless unless you can, at least in terms of absolutism. So I guess Qohelet appealed to me from that perspective, and it has from then on to the present. I mean, just three years ago, I guess I published another book on Qohelet, The Ironic Wink, and all these articles were spun out off of writing that book. You know, when you come down to it, Qohelet says, "Doubt everything," and that's exactly my approach to the study of the Bible. And I see the Bible fundamentally as a literary construct. Hmm. That is, it is a human document. And whether it is more than that, there's no way of saying. And any claim to the Bible's self-authentication is false. It cannot self-validate. And so I see the Bible as a human, broken testimony. Broken testimony to perceived transcendence. It is perceived. Whether there's anything beyond that, I have no way of knowing. Mm-hmm. But it is broken testimony, and it is testimony from people who lived in a theocentric universe, in a pre-scientific, non-philosophical world. And that's so different from ours. But Koheleth, at least, is he speaks to us in terms of things that we can accept. He says, look, doubt everything, and there's life is a toil. Mm-hmm. Life is simply the waste of breathing. Hevel is his term. So lately I've been really interested in two concepts, and one is the notion of chinam, and that's from the Job. It's central to Job, and it means without purpose, gratuitously. And this adversary questions Job's integrity and raises the issue that is paramount. In other words, does Job serve you gratuitously, mm-hmm. for no purpose, without thought of the carrot or the stick? And that issue has become extremely important in my thinking about the texts. And the other one is Hevel. That is, life is it's either absurd, or it is meaningless, or it is ephemeral, short-lived. And Koheleth and Job obviously are the two books to which I gravitate, mm-hmm. And those are the emphases that I find in them. Not only is the Bible, this broken testimony, but the Bible is stammering. In other words, when we talk about transcendence, we can only stammer. We can't be eloquent. How can we describe that which is beyond us? So the principle of similarity is crucial. In other words, if God is not similar to us, then all analogies are meaningless. And so there's a number of scholars have emphasized similarity in talking about theological discourse in the ancient Near East. And the only way it can become meaningful is for the analogies that we draw from everyday experience, and that's what wisdom is all about, that these analogies have some affinities with reality. Mm-hmm. And if God is not like us, then all these analogies are just waste of time. So I call it we're stammering, because we aren't able to talk about that which is hidden, that which is pure mystery. And that's the bane of theology. I've spent my whole life studying the most difficult question of all, the problem of theodicy. Mm-hmm. And I have recently written several encyclopedia articles for Oxford and others, and I wrote that book, Defending God, mm-hmm. that is an attempt to say there are 10 different explanations for divine justice, and in the ancient Near East as well. Recently Bill Brown has written a book on wisdom in which he emphasizes wonder. Mm-hmm. And to me, wonder or amazement in the presence of the divine is absolutely crucial. Mm. And so, in spite of much of my life, I have attacked a lot of the people who take the Bible without a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. I also have great appreciation for the beauty of much of the Bible. Mm. And for the texts, love your neighbor as yourself, and the visions of the prophets. Mm-hmm. And my favorite is this text, and it uses the language of teacher for God. From Isaiah, and it says, God will give you the bread of adversity and water of affliction. And when you begin to take a step, he will whisper from your shoulder and say, walk this way. The mystical aspect, mm-hmm. Is also important to me. Mm-hmm. So wonder and amazement. I've written some poetry in which I talk about, for example, the tear. I say, had God known the course of those first words, he would never have spoken. Mm. Ripping night from day, land from sea, you from me. Instead, he uttered his voice, and it exploded the silence of eternity, and then it resulted in a shriek. There's my attempt to find something in the Bible that is authoritative and meaningful. Mm-hmm. And it's Koheleth is I guess speaks to me from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the the non-Koheleth chapter in the book.
Oh boy. Yes.
Which is the one on Genesis 22. Right. Known as the Akedah, or Binding of Isaac, which you admit is, or not admit, but you say is not an example of wisdom literature, mm-hmm. but it stands at a level of theological profundity with Job and Koheleth. You have a lot of problems with the way this story has been interpreted, and I think you have problems with the story itself, although you give an interpretation. So what are some of these problems, and mm-hmm. How do you see what you call divine vulnerability as a mm-hmm. potential way of understanding this text?
Yes, this is my third attempt to understand that text, and I'm in good company. Rembrandt has three attempts. Kierkegaard also has three. And Gerhard von Rad wrote, in fact, his last book, his wife was reading the proofs of it to him when he the day he died. Fenrad wrote one, Das Opfer des Avraham, mm-hmm. and on the he has the Rembrandt pictures. And Kierkegaard recognized that there's a problem with the story. I mean, the problem is children reading this. Mm. You know, the effect on children. Would my dad kill me? Mm. So there's that psychological problem that in a number of places they're saying you should not read that text to the children. Mm. So I have that difficulty with it. And beyond that, the difficulty is, how can you believe God would do something like that? And we've had examples of people who have claimed that God spoke to them. Any claim that God is speaking to you raises eyebrows. And it certainly would raise eyebrows for Immanuel Kant, who recognized that if that's God speaking, then it's not the God we know. Does God demand something like that? So that's the issue that the text raises for me. Mm-hmm. And I would say absolutely not. The story, though, is exquisite, as I try to mm-hmm. Show in the literary interpretations of it. What was its purpose? And at least I believe it was to represent a new ideal that the claim, the demand in Deuteronomy, not in Deuteronomy, in Exodus, your firstborn you shall offer up to me, and you shall do the same with your sheep and oxen and so forth. And that's still in the Bible. So it is an attempt to say that obedience to that command is not necessary. So if if you are willing to offer your son, then your willingness to do so is adequate. It is sufficient. The story then serves that purpose, and it means that we no longer have to offer up our firstborn. Mm-hmm. It is clear that as late as 8th century, or at least 7th century, eighth century, Micah was saying, "Shall I give the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?" Mm. In other words, what does God require of me? The very best. And the question is, should I do that? And this story says no. Mm. And we know that by even later, the 6th century, with Ezekiel and Jeremiah, there was extensive offering of infants. And both prophets attacked that practice. Mm. So the story is certainly timely, and it served a purpose. Mm-hmm. That's why I think at least it's in the Bible. The problem I have about divine vulnerability, what I was trying to say, probably inadequately, is that that today belief in God is extremely iffy, questionable. And The reason for it is religious pluralism, the globalization of scholarship, the recognition that there are alternatives to Judaism and to Christianity. Mm-hmm. Then if that is the case, and in a scientific world like ours, can we any longer believe in divine proclamations? Mm. Can we any longer believe that God chooses prophets and chooses sages and all of this? And can we believe in the kind of God that the Bible describes? Mm-hmm. And I think, especially in a Jewish community where the Holocaust has taken place, mm-hmm. and God did not show up, and in Christianity, which has as its very central theme a dying God, can those possibilities and realities, can they be sustained by a belief in God? Hmm. And so I think God is vulnerable, in that sense. And, Abraham Joshua Heschel emphasized divine pathos, the suffering of God, which is the theme in Christian faith. And it makes it very difficult to believe in a God when those are the themes. Mm-hmm. So that's what I meant by divine vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And it's whether it communicates adequately or not, I don't know.
That's what you were, what you were intending. One final question to ask you to engage a little prediction. In the introduction to Volume 1, you mentioned some predictions you made more than 40 years ago about what scholars of biblical wisdom would be focusing on in the future. And, I think you did pretty well. Mm-hmm. You got 3 out of 5. 60% success rate. So if you, as you look at wisdom scholarship now, and as you, that's what you've done essentially in these two volumes, what do you see?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish I could have the same success I did back in 1968 when I predicted that the next thing we would hear in wisdom literature would be somebody claiming that the succession document was wisdom. And before the end of the semester, that happened. Whitebury's article came out. So I was 100% there. On this one, I'm afraid I'll flunk. I think the next few years we'll see continued emphasis on the consequences of wisdom. Hmm. What C. Al has, hmm. he calls it consequences. Mm-hmm. And others simply the history of interpretation. Hmm. Samuel Valentine has a marvelous book on Job. And the interpretations throughout history, my own commentary on Job talks about the history of interpretation. And now Leong's massive, what I have in a review called a masterpiece, has also emphasized the nexus of consequence. So I think that's going to continue. I think with Koheleth, it's taking a different turn from Job. And that Jenny Barber has a book on the function of Solomon in Koheleth and the royal ideology. Mm-hmm. I think she's wrong. I wrote a long review of it. But I think that it's very suggestive, the echoes of earlier insights, echoes of earlier traditions. So that kind of thing will probably continue. And the book by Antoine Shores of Leuven, a massive study of Koheleth, emphasizes interpretation by the early church. And I think that's going to be an important thing. I also believe that apocalyptic is going to have to be studied more thoroughly. Collins has a wonderful several books on apocalyptic, and my own student Thea Portier Young, her book on apocalyptic and empire. I think that will continue. And what I would love to see is more emphasis on the sayings of Kabir, for example, Indian thought. And I think we need to branch out for parallels that are not just ancient Near Eastern, but I'd like to see them go beyond the ancient Near East to Chinese. I know there are many proverbial sayings, Confucius, the similarities between Confucius and Koheleth that Rami has emphasized. I think those can be developed even further, and I hope that will take place. But who knows?
I'm not sure how many predictions we had there, so I'm not sure if we can calculate a percentage at some point, but that might be...
three, I guess.
Well, thank you again for talking with me about your book.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And about wisdom in general and Koheleth and so many things. Thank you. Again, I've been talking with James Crenshaw about his recent two-volume work, Sipping from the Cup of Wisdom, which was recently published by Smith and Helwys. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.